This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey joins us later in the hour to discuss the latest with the migrants flown from Texas to Martha's Vineyard. We turn now to our guests here in Studio 2, Joel Christian Gill. Inaugural chair of Boston University's MFA in Visual Narrative, is back to help us continue our dive into the world of comics. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And you've brought with you a guest, Meg Rotzel, who's curator of exhibitions for the Harvard Radcliffe Institute. Meg, welcome to you, too.
I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And Joel, you wanted us to meet Meg because of an exhibit that is called Drawing Us Together, Public Life and Public Health in Contemporary Comics. It's at the Radcliffe Institute, and I'm going to begin with, I'm sorry, what?
So, you know, thinking about comics, which you've heard me say before, comics are a sneaky way to teach people stuff, right? So as we've started the process of thinking about comics in a broader context, more people are reaching out to comics, which is why Meg's show is really important, because it's talking about, it's using the symbolic language that we've talked about a little bit before to communicate in ways that we can't do it. So it's like a deeper thing. Like you almost don't know that you're reading something and you're learning something. And the show, I'll let Meg talk about some of the show, but the show was really great because it actually shows a lot of, it focuses on the attack on democracy or how our democracy works and how our healthcare system works. So Meg, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So that's the public health.
That's the
public life and the public health.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I was really interested in these graphic guides that come from the Center for Cartoon Studies. One of our fellows, James Sturm, was working on these. And there is two in this this series, one on democracy and one on the healthcare system. And I was having a really hard time reading back during the period of quarantine. And I got a hold of these two graphic guides. And when I was reading both of them, I started realizing that at this particular moment in time, there I had never seen our healthcare and our health so politicized. And so I started reading in these two areas. And I'm not a comic book person, but because I
not
was
yet.
Well, I mean, maybe I am now. I think maybe I am now. And I began getting comic books from the Harvard Library System, and I realized many of them were actually coming from the medical library, the Countway Medical Library. And so I started reading deeply into these two areas of democracy. Or finding that books were coming under, for me, democracy and healthcare. And so I've organized this exhibition around these two themes and then have created a library of over 80 comics that people can come and browse at the exhibition. And then you can also draw and
make some mini comics.
Make some mini comics, yes.
So there's a piece of me that thinks, well, yeah, that makes total sense when you bring in the democracy piece. I mean, political cartoons, for example, have been part of our public discussion since we've had newspapers, for example. At first, I was more surprised about the health dimension. And then I thought about those smiley faces to frowny faces in an emergency room, like where you give your pain level, right? And you point to the one.
Yep.
Is that the basis of what we're talking about here when we talk about comics as a way to communicate health and public health information?
In 2015, the word of the year was the LOL emoji. And when you look at how language evolves, it evolves in a way that starts with images, and then it evolves into a pictorial language, right? And that's the idea of how comics work. And I think when looking at, you know, graphic medicine, shout out to Matthew Noah, right?
Because Matthew
is a librarian over there who's dope. You know, like I think when you take that information and you're looking at ways to talk to different people, right? When you're looking at different ways to communicate to a large population, one of the key ways to do that is with visual language. And what better way to do that than to communicate with visual language and pictures in the form of comics? When you stop thinking about how comics are basically superheroes, and I think that's really interesting because when I was at the museum with at the Radcliffe yesterday with Meg, and it was interesting that she hadn't put any superhero comics. And I was like, talk about like how, like, because most people's intro into comics is superheroes, right. And yours isn't.
Yeah, mine is not. Mine is because I think I'm such a visual thinker that what I was really looking for was almost nonfiction comics. So I was particularly interested when reading experiences of illness, experiences of mental health, experiences of grief. And that is something that is really hard to see with people. Like, we've all had those experiences. We're human. But then when I
Wait, what do you mean it's difficult to see with people?
Like, we all know that the person next to us has likely been sick, has experienced grief, but it's not something, I mean, it shows, but also in our day-to-day life, that narrative kind of goes away. It's hidden. And then when I was reading experiences in those areas, I had a deep connection and felt empathy towards others, but I also could recognize things in my own self, particularly during the period of quarantine, in mental health, and that there something came alive for me there. And the same thing was going on when I made some selections for our democracy wall. Like, we have historical narratives and that sort of thing, but we also have stories about coming to America or being first and second generation. We have experience of, like, what it's like to be a particular person that I am not. And I found that to be so moving that I wanted to make an exhibition about it.
And I think that's like the beauty of comics, right? Because you're talking exactly about the thing that I spend a lot of time talking to people about when I talk about comics, which mm-hmm. is the ability to create empathy, right? And that expressive cartooning, which people think, oh, that's really simple. But it's like, that is the thing that when we see that smiley face, right? You always hear, like, we're changing the color of the thumbs up emoji, right? So that it's brown, so that it's more inclusive. Nobody ever changes the color of the smiley face emoji, right? Because we see ourselves in that,
yes.
Right? That because it's so nonspecific that we actually can pour ourselves into it, right? It becomes a vessel for who we are. And that's why I think comics and medicine is an important thing, or comics and journalism, or
yes.
just broaden the understanding about how comics are not just, you know, superheroes. They are a broader thing.
So we're talking public life and public health and comics. We just heard Joel Christian Gill here in Studio 2, inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA in Visual Narrative. We also have here Meg Rotzel, who's the curator of exhibitions at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute, where there is an exhibit on this here. Mm-hmm. Pick it back up, Meg.
Yeah. So in this exhibition, I'm really hoping that people who are really into comics and people who are new to comics come, and that they're able to see narratives across the spectrum of different kinds of people and their experience in America.
So for people who are new to comics, they may not even know how to imagine what we're talking about. So describe one comic in the exhibit that's public health.
One that is public health. Well, I have to talk about the graphic guide to public health then. So this comic, which is made by the Center for Cartoon Studies and James Sturm, actually with students from Harvard, is drawn in the Richard Scarry style, and it shows kind of how our public health system is created and its history. And one of my favorite spreads is actually of a hospital, and it's thinking about finance. Like, our medical bills are so hard, if you even see one, are really hard to understand. And this image is actually of, if you remember Busy Town, like a hospital that's cut in half. And inside of that, you can see all of these different hospital rooms, lab rooms, this
like,
and that.
Like a cross-section
yeah,
of a hospital.
Exactly. And all the animals are doing their thing. And then there's all of this like language around it that says, like, this person just gave birth. This is something that's about, like, giving birth in the system. This are some labs. Did you know that this could be counted in this way or that way with financially? And so you actually see the broad spread of what is happening in the hospital, but what's also happening in these outside systems and experiences.
So, Joel, how about an example? You've seen the exhibit,
yeah.
right? You're doing a panel this afternoon, and we'll give the information for people who are interested in that at the end.
Yes.
What about a political example, a public life example?
Well, this is what democracy looks like. It's on the other wall. So that's actually perfect. Like, you talk about the healthcare, I'll talk about democracy. And it basically goes through And just to give people a sense, like when you walk into the space, these are giant comics on the wall. So you can actually read an excerpt of what the comics are, which is really important when you're thinking about comics in museums and museum spaces, because for the artist, it's not the individual page or the art, it's the actual story. And so it goes through a process of like, you know, how the federal government works, how we vote for people, what that means. It has it's really amazingly designed by Dan Knott, mm-hmm. Who is also at the Center for Cartoon Studies. And it just walks you through that. But then other examples of books in there, Run, which is John Lewis's the second series, is also in there, which talks about his run for Congress. What's the George Takei?
So, just to clarify for listeners, the late John Lewis, civil rights activist, who also served in Congress, and there was this series,
March. Yeah. March, which was written by Andrew Iden and drawn by Nate Powell. So the second series, and I'm forgetting the artist's name now, but Andrew drew that. Nate drew the cover, and it's a very powerful book. But there's also Rebecca Hall's Wake is in there, which is a history of women-led slave rebellions. And I'm thinking menopause is in there.
Yeah, lots of women's health, too.
Lots of women's health, which I think is really important, specifically because Black women are being treated like Black men, based on how doctors are doing to Black women what the police are doing to Black men. So I think that's a really important thing. Given that comics have this tendency to teach in this way that people don't understand. I just remember my grandmother who was 90, she passed away over the summer, but I would give her my comics, and I don't think she spent a lot of time reading books, but she would read them cover to cover, mm-hmm. right? And I think that thing is like, and the title of the exhibition is Drawing Us Together. And I think comics are a perfect thing to draw us together because, like I said, when you see those individual expressive cartooning drawings, you feel like you feel yourself. When you look at those images of people on the wall, you don't see other people. You see yourself in that position.
So Joel Kristen Gill and Meg Rotzel are here in Studio 2. We're talking about democracy, public life, public health, and comics. Just to go back to a point you made, Joel, there is research to demonstrate that Black women in healthcare are believed less, have poorer outcomes, et cetera, just to underscore that part there. So another thread, and Meg, I'll turn to you on this, another thread that I'm interested in picking up on this. Again, I'm unabashed in my novice nature here, right?
Also a novice a little over here, too.
And I'm good with that.
I'll be the expert for both of them.
There you go. You run the expert lane. This empathy piece mm-hmm. and this education piece is interesting because I have been socialized to think of comics as either silly or cynical.
Uh-huh.
And you are presenting neither.
Yes. But as I was speaking with your producer earlier, there is a sense of play there. And I think that is something that is key to understanding. So when I was talking about how I couldn't read, it's not that I'm not literate. It's that I was under so much stress of just getting the day done under the conditions that we're under.
This is 2020, if anybody cannot remember what that was like.
The 10 years of 2020.
Yeah, thank you. And that the part of me that was available to be playful, which is a visual part of me and also something that really keeps me together, was gone. I had lost it. And through images, I could see other artists playing, and I could see them using the medium, using color, using line, and actually using the way that things appear on the page, like the gutter. Expert, I want you to talk a little bit about the gutter.
Where all the magic happens.
Yeah. And that playfulness, like, allowed me to take in, like, some deeper, heavier things, and I could engage in these very, very important topics.
So we have a couple minutes left.
Yes,
so you get either that or the gutter.
I'm going to talk about the gutter. I'm going to talk about the gutter because I think it's a really important, and it's like a magical thing in comics. The gutter is that place in which the cartoonist and the reader have a pact. And the cartoonist basically throws you the lob, and you, the reader, have to hit it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you have to make that connection between those two panels. And when we
you're talking about that space between
Yeah, I'm talking
panels.
About yep. that space. That's where that happens, right? And if you are a great cartoonist, James is a great cartoonist, mm-hmm. Nate is a great cartoonist, they do that really well to the point where you feel like you automatically know what's going to happen. You don't have to think about it. It's like this thing that comes along. And then the words actually add to that, which is the power of comics. I am an evangelist for comics, if nothing else.
So one last thing, and Meg, This isn't the only exhibit. Boston College actually has one on comics as well, American Alternative Comics 1980 to 2000. Are we at a stage where we will see more curation of comics coming forward?
I definitely think so, because Montserrat College also has a show that's up as well. I think that this is a moment.
And BU has one coming in the spring.
Yeah. Somebody's, sorry, just, never mind. I'm just getting a note on the board and it doesn't help me in this case. Live radio, folks, that's where we are. All right, so this is Meg Rotzel, who's curator of exhibitions for the Harvard Radcliffe Institute, and Joel Christian Gill, inaugural chair of Boston University's Masters of Fine Art in Visual Narrative. You can hear more from the two of them on this exhibit in a virtual panel discussion at 4 p.m. today. We have information about it as available at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute website, and the exhibit, Drawing Us Together, is on display through December 17th. I got all that out.
I know, that's great.
It was wonderful to have both of you. I appreciate it. And Joel, you'll come back again. We're going to keep this project up.
I will be back again.
I am falling in love as we go along.
And I will tune in.
Excellent. Tonight, the Boston Symphony Orchestra is set to open their 2022-2023 season at Symphony Hall. And among those who will be playing is classical concert pianist, violinist, and conductor Awa Dajan Pratt. And one of the pieces he'll play is by composer, violinist, and educator Jesse Montgomery. Tonight will be Awa Dajan Pratt's debut with the BSO. Here's Jesse Montgomery playing one of her compositions, her song Strum, with the Catalyst Quartet. That gives us a flavor there of Jesse Montgomery's compositions. She tells me she considers herself a violinist and composer, but Pratt has commissioned a piece by her that will be performed tonight. Awa Dajan Pratt, Jesse Montgomery, joined us ahead of the season opener to talk about it. And I started by asking Awa Dajan Pratt about what it's like performing with different orchestras.
Orchestras sound different, and each hall is also different, adding another layer of dimension to the experience. But, you know, this orchestra sounds good. It's a very good orchestra.
That is a good thing to hear.
Yeah.
So, Jesse, are you aware of that when you're writing and composing, that many different performers will play your music? Or do you write the music and then understand that there will be many interpretations and you just have to let that go?
It's probably a little bit of both. You know, I write with the intention of it getting performed by multiple people or orchestras or ensembles. And there are certain things that are like pretty fixed in terms of what I would expect. But there's always, from one performance to the next, there's going to be, you know, each orchestra has their own interesting peculiarities that they work out in rehearsal and, you know, bring their special interpretation to the piece. And that's what makes the actual process special, is allowing for those variants to happen.
So, Awa Dajan, as I understand it, you actually were part of the group that commissioned rounds specifically from Jesse Montgomery as a composer. So talk about that. Why, Jesse? Why do this now?
It was part of a larger project called Still Point, where there's seven composers taking inspiration from lines of T.S. Eliot, from the four quartets, from Burnt Norton at the Still Point of the Turning World. At the Still Point of the Turning World, there the dance is sort of the paraphrase of those five lines. And Jesse and I met when she was still playing with the Catalyst Quartet. We were playing all together in Alaska some chamber music. And during the course of the week, you know, we're all talking and hanging out. And Jesse, I think, was just about to sort of, or contemplating the pivot to full-time composing. And just from having known her that week and just her intelligence and power as a person and thoughtfulness and the kind of musician that she was playing, that I thought, if I ever have the chance to have her write a piece for me, then, you know, I will. So the opportunity arose and it worked out.
I want to bring some of your music, Jesse, to the listeners here. And Awa Dajan, you just mentioned the Catalyst Quartet. So this is actually a little bit, Jesse, you're one of the instrumentalists on this. This is the piece Strum from the album Strum by the Catalyst Quartet. So So we have almost a little bit of intrigue here, Jesse, because we can't use the music that Awadajan will be performing tomorrow night. And so I wanted to bring a bit of the flavor of your work to the listener. And what I like about this is not just the flavor of your work as a composer, but also as an artist. Mm-hmm. And when you thought about the challenge of something like T.S. Eliot, and you know somebody like Awadajan Pratt eventually is going to play it, how do you unlock what that unlocks in you and put it forth as music?
What was special was actually when Awadajan asked me to write this piece, and especially in this setting, which is like a concerto setting, you know, where there's, you know, he's the soloist and the piano is a solo instrument. So much of what I thought about and how I thought about the piece had to do with Awadajan himself and Awadajan as a player. And it was exciting, you know, to have Awadajan reach out and say, don't worry about the whole piano thing. You're going to be fine. You know, bring your, and, you know, it was very encouraging to say, you know, your artistry, your creativity is going to help. That's what we want. And that was what was intriguing. And whatever you write is going to be fine. You know, I had actually a few experiences, Awadajan, I don't even know if you would remember this, but where I played in orchestras where you were the soloist, there was something about, you know, the sort of real meticulousness in your approach and playing. And that was also inspiring.
Do you think you're meticulous, Awadajan?
I mean, yes, I do. but it's not, yeah, I guess I would say that I'm particular and pay close attention to, I guess I am.
We're speaking with Awadajan Pratt, who's a pianist, a violinist, and a conductor, and Jesse Montgomery, who's a composer, a violinist, and a teacher. Awadajan Pratt will be performing the music Rounds that Jesse Montgomery wrote at the Boston Symphony Orchestra this week. And we wanted to bring together this artist of firsts and this young upcoming composer to talk about that performance and this moment. Awadajan, you are a lifetime of firsts, including National Music Awards, and you've received honorary degrees, and you are a Black artist who has performed a list of symphonies. At one point, I thought, well, maybe I'll memorize that. Forget it. That's not going to happen. But you've also come into you brought classical music into some different places. I want to have a little fun with that, and I'm going to start with, you appeared on Sesame Street.
Hi there.
Hi, Big Bird. Warning technique.
Thank you. Oh, I love playing the piano.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love playing the piano also.
Really? You play?
Yes, I've played since I was 6 years old.
So you've played since you were 6 years old, but you're like one of those people that the rest of us almost doesn't want to be around, because you also know wine, and you could have been a championship competitive tennis player, and you play like more than one instrument, and you conduct, and you do Sesame Street. And how do you hold it all in your head and in your hands? And how did you pick who you wanted to be?
That's a heavy question. I think starting from the end, growing up, it was a lot of music and a lot of tennis, and probably more tennis than music. At the end of the day, I was preparing for college and what to major in. And I realized that if I didn't have music in a given day, that would not be a good day for me. And if I didn't play tennis or write or do whatever else that I was interested in, that I would be fine. So that was the determinant. You know, it's crazy. It's 30 years now of doing this. It's pretty wonderful.
So in 2009, you, Awadajan, played at the White House. President Barack Obama, the First Lady Michelle Obama, and an audience. Here's a little bit of that. So that's Awadajan Pratt performing Bach's Passacaglia. I hope I'm pronouncing
right.
Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor at the White House in 2009. And actually, Jesse Montgomery, I'm going to turn back to you here. You are a young woman of color who our producer Bart Tachi pointed out, looking at some of your music on YouTube, that one of the comments somebody said, thank you so much for making classical music accessible again. I could almost dance to this, right? And here you've got somebody who's going to play Bach and Montgomery at the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Are you at a stage in your career where you're like, yeah, of course? Or are you still at Bach and Montgomery?
No. I was definitely outside the hall today taking photos of the, you know, the banner, the posters that are up, and just gleaming with pride, you know, just very proud of where I am at the moment. I called my dad as I was walking over because I wanted to check in. I said, Dad, do you remember when I was 17 and you took me to my NEC audition? And I said, you remember you took me to my NEC audition and I did my audition in jeans? Look at me now. I said, I'm standing outside the hall getting ready for rehearsal. And we had a little moment there.
What did he say?
He's perpetually proud of me. We just laughed at the irony.
Jesse, I'm going to play a little bit more of your music here. This is Breakaway from your album Strum, Music for Strings. Jesse, who are you as a composer?
You know what? I'm a violinist who composes. I feel like my music is very much comes out of my experience as a player and also as a listener. Like I've always enjoyed listening to lots of different kinds of music. And it's my first lesson that I give to students is we create a listening list together, basically. I think one of the most important things that a composer can do is to listen to lots of different music and just start to notice what's attractive about whatever you're listening to. So I think of myself as a deep listener and player and collaborator. Awadajan and I went back and forth quite a bit on this piece. And so that actual back and forth is also really important to me.
Is the piece still evolving? And I can ask both of you that. Is the piece still evolving?
The cadenza is something that is evolving every time. There are things still, as with happens with any great piece of music, that I'm discovering still, you know. So I've played it, this will, I think, the 10th performance. But yeah, I'm still hearing and discovering relationships, so it's pretty cool.
What's on your listening list, Jesse?
My listening list right now includes a lot of pop music, the new Beyoncé album, and the instrumentals and the production are pretty amazing.
And Awadajan, how about you? Something on your listening list?
Yeah, this is shameful. Like, you know, I used to listen to a ton of music all the time until I started teaching. And then, you know, you teach all day and then you practice and I don't. It's, you know, just some, my ears are tired. I listened to a lot of music before starting this project of composers that I didn't know. But I seriously haven't put anything I'm so old fashioned, I'm going to say CD. It's been a while.
So last question to each of you. And Awadajan, I'm going to ask you yours first. And then, Jesse, I'll end with you. Awadajan, when people hear Rounds tomorrow night, what do you want them to feel? What do you want them to think?
I want people to come in and receive it as they do, you know. So for me, what it means is that two people sitting next to each other will receive the piece differently. A person who hears it one day will receive it differently because the time they're hearing it, their day will have been different, even the next day. And that allows for a certain kind of breadth of experience as opposed to going in and saying, okay, I'm supposed to feel something, you know. You know, the responses that I've gotten over the course of these months has been, you know, really gratifying, I think, for both of us, that the piece moves people and gives them joy. But maybe it makes other people sad in moments. And I just want to admit all of those possibilities for every listener.
Is that true for you too, Jesse? Or is there something you're hoping that people will feel or experience when they hear Awadajan and the Boston Symphony Orchestra perform Rounds?
I feel similarly to Awadajan. But I just hope they enjoy it, that they get some kind of joy out of it, that it, you know, sparks the imagination in some way. That's what we always hope for. either joy or sadness or, you know, whatever it brings up, but that it, you know, offers some intrigue of some kind to, you know, keep exploring new music and creating space for new music to grow and thrive in our field.
Any kind of reaction is better than like, okay. right. We'll take any. Except,
take it or leave it.
Yeah. Except.
On that note, Awa Dajan Pratt, who is a pianist, a violinist, and a conductor, along with Jesse Montgomery, a composer, violinist, and teacher who tells us she's a violinist who's a composer. Jesse Montgomery has composed the piece Rounds. Awa Dajan Pratt will be playing it with the Boston Symphony Orchestra at Symphony Hall on September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. and September 23rd at 1:30 p.m. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find more information on the concerts at bso.org, and we will go out on some Beyoncé now, thanks to Jesse. This is Break My Soul from her new album, Renaissance. One Boston artist is on a mission to help the world understand the African diaspora across Latin America. WBUR's Cris de la Guerra introduces us to poet and activist Yvette Modestin.
One of the first times I met Yvette Modestin, she was leading a workshop for a group of girls, mostly of Dominican descent. She went down the line, gently asking each person how they identify. Some would say Latina, or refer to their family's homeland. Very few uttered the word Black. When they did, a couple started to cry. This type of anti-racist training is at the heart of Modestin's work.
This is all about reparations and reparative justice. I want my love for my Blackness, I want people to feel it. I want people to see it. I want people to hear it.
And by hearing it, repair and deconstruct this denial of Blackness in Latin America. Modestin grew up in Colón, Panama's second largest province, a city that was segregated during the first 8 years of her life. It remains predominantly Black.
I think it was a blessing in the sense because it centered me in my Blackness. Mm-hmm. I also had daily visuals of a Black doctor, a Black nurse, my own mother, you know, a Black police officer, a Black firefighter. So I walked around daily with people that looked like me. You know, I didn't have to explain myself.
Or her locks, which she wears proudly. Hair is sacred to Modestin, which she writes about in her poem, An Ode to Mi Corona.
From the plait, to the cornrow, to the afro, to the locks, you have stayed with me, reminding me of an unconditional joy and love of our Blackness.
Modestin works around the world with the UN. Locally, she works with theater companies, museums, and nonprofits. She paints and has written books and worked on a documentary about the Black history of her nation. In this way, she unites cultures and expands minds. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Cris de la Guerra.
Call it your crown, la corona, your antenna, for the message of the ancestors sits deep within, waiting for you to say, I am here, estoy aquí, free, libre.
Cristela's story is part of our week-long series, The Makers, highlighting local artists of color. Today on WBUR's All Things Considered, we'll meet photographer and dancer Olivia Moon. And to see photos and videos of all the artists we've featured, you can visit WBUR.org. It's been just over a week since Florida Governor Ron DeSantis flew roughly 50 Southern migrants, mostly Venezuelan, from San Antonio, Texas, to Martha's Vineyard. Now, as the shock wore off from that, questions have emerged about legality and accountability. And while DeSantis is saying it's just the beginning, it seems time to dig into some of those questions. Joining us on the line to do so, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator Markey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's so great to be with you again.
I appreciate having you. And Senator, we have tried really hard over the last week here on Radio Boston to keep all of our conversations and coverage rooted in the experience of the individuals and families who came on that plane. And I want to start there with you. Have you spoken with or heard from any of the migrants?
Well, my staff up in Boston, they're an incredibly great team, have been talking to all of the officials who are processing their claims. But I do think it's important, obviously, to understand their story right from the beginning, which is that Venezuela is in a state of political chaos, and that more than 6 million people have fled Venezuela over the last year. And in fact, even in our own country right now, there is a grant that has been put in place for 300,000 Venezuelans to have temporary protected status in our country. So these are 50 people from Venezuela, which is a small part of the larger story from Venezuela. And so I think if we can step back and realize that Colombia has accepted 2.5 million of the Venezuelans who are fleeing that chaos, maybe this country that has a Statue of Liberty as its symbol can say, well, those 50 people are just part of that larger story. And that's how the residents of Martha's Vineyard and the state of Massachusetts are reacting to this. And if there are more that come, we will continue to keep our door open and give them the help which they need.
So take me behind the scenes for a minute, Senator Markey. When did you hear first about the flight? I know when I did, I almost had trouble making sense of it, really understanding what was happening. When did you first hear the news? And what were your first responses in your gut?
I first heard about it from Congressman Keating about 2 hours after they had landed. And my first reaction was that it was a political stunt by Ron DeSantis, that it's a vile competition, an unconscionable competition, which Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, are engaged in order to win the mantle of the post-Trump right-wing, make America hate again, great again by making America hate again campaign that Trump initiated back in 2016. So that was my first reaction, that it's just a further example of how far off the traditional welcoming attitude that our country has had to those who are desperate from other countries.
And we will get more to the politics, especially in the policy, especially around Governor DeSantis. But one more question on this front. If you were welcoming one of the migrants into your family room right now, what would you want to say? You grab their hand, you shake their hand. It's clear you're very proud of how the people on Martha's Vineyard responded, as I think the whole Commonwealth is. What would you say?
I would say that you should know that you won't have to worry as long as you are here. That after Hurricane Maria, thousands of people came from Puerto Rico to Massachusetts, and their children were put in the school system, and there was housing provided for those families. And after the Afghan crisis, Massachusetts welcomed thousands of refugees just in the last year. And those children are in public school system. There is housing and food for them. And when Ukraine started to have a crisis early this year, similarly, Ukrainians are now in Massachusetts. So don't worry, okay? There's plenty of precedent just in the last few years that's gonna give you a guarantee that you won't have to have any concerns, especially for your children. Okay, we're very, very concerned about you and your family, and we will make sure that you will get anything that you need. And I will give you that personal guarantee. That is what I would say to them in my living room. I will give you my personal guarantee that your family will be protected.
So let's move now into the policy questions and the politics questions. And we're speaking with Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey about the migrants who were flown. Governor Ron DeSantis has taken responsibility of it, potentially under false pretenses or tricked into flying to Martha's Vineyard from Texas last week. You've supported raising the refugee cap. The president did so last year. Do we need to do more of that? Would you like to see the cap raised again?
Yeah, we obviously have to do a lot more. Venezuelans have now surpassed Guatemalans and Hondurans to become the second largest nationality stopped at the U.S. border. And as I said, around 6 million Venezuelans have fled their country, mostly to Latin America. But here in the United States, we have now lifted our temporary protected status number up to 300,000. And 111,000 beneficiaries from Venezuela have already accepted that designation inside of our state, inside of our country. So we just have to continue to step back and increase dramatically the number of refugees that are annually admitted to the United States. We're a country of 330 million people. 50 people is something that is almost a statistical, you know, it's so small statistically, and it doesn't even register. We could accept easily 100,000, 200, 300, 500,000 refugees a year and be able to accommodate them, and we should inside of our borders.
So let's get at the heart of this then. So I hear you say that, and I hear Florida, Texas, Arizona say, great, we'll send them.
Well, Massachusetts welcomes immigrants, including the new arrivals who came to Martha's Vineyard last week. That's separate from whether or not Ron DeSantis is engaging in indefensible and cruel conduct, lying to travel-weary immigrant women and men and children to put them onto planes to unknown destinations. That's not a sustainable or suitable solution. We have to treat people with dignity and respect, which is why after 9 years, oh Lord, the Republicans should come to the table so we can put together a comprehensive immigration bill. They have not been willing to negotiate with Democrats for 9 years.
And what is the centerpiece of that? So, you know, it is very complicated. And I recognize I'm asking the easy question, right, in a very complex policy environment. But the centerpiece, with what you know now over this 9 year period, the single most important piece of that reform, Senator Markey, what is it?
The single most important part is that it has to be bipartisan, and that when the solution is constructed, that it is agreed to by both parties. Donald Trump actually walked away from the negotiating table with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in 2017. They were getting very close to a comprehensive deal, but Trump would rather have the issue than have the solution.
So why is bipartisanship then so, I mean, I'm wondering, at the surface level, we always want bipartisanship, but it sounds like you're saying something more fundamental here.
I'm saying that, unfortunately, Donald Trump and his now many acolytes all across the country would rather demonize Mexicans and Venezuelans and Muslims and LGBTQ plus community members and issue after issue in order to pander to their right-wing white base, the Go Brandon crowd. And unfortunately, that's now too large a portion of the Republican base in our country.
Do you feel that there are seeds? So I hear you. I also hear you talking about the moral dimension of this. And across the country, we've heard lots of voices raised in concern about respect for human dignity, avoiding cruelty, showing empathy and compassion. Do you see seeds? I want to believe, I certainly have to believe that in Congress, there are people who will recoil at cruelty across the board. Do you see seeds of a potential compromise now in the moment that we're in?
Well, we always have been a nation of immigrants. Our economy and our security are stronger because of the immigrant families who have enriched our nation since its founding. I think we have a problem, though, with too many conservative MAGA Republicans in our country, is that they do not want to construct in any way a pathway to citizenship for any of these people. They won't even work with us to protect the DACA young people. Is 800,000 young people who have gone from grammar school through high school and college in our country, who have joined our military. There's 800,000 of them, and they still won't allow us to pass legislation in order to protect them. So if we can't reach agreement on those young people who actually never did grow up in these other countries, I think it's going to be very hard for us to reach an agreement until Trump and his acolytes are no longer the controlling influence inside of the Republican Party. It's going to get worse and worse. I think a lot of people would have said it's impossible to pass gun violence legislation, but it just got so bad that ultimately Republicans, enough Republicans, crossed the aisle earlier this year that we could begin to pass the best gun violence legislation that we've been able to get the votes for in 30 years. But even that is just a very small sliver of this whole set of gun violence issues that we have to deal with. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but we need to start somewhere. I would start with the DACA kids, these 800,000 young people, try to get an agreement. But the Republicans are so frightened of Donald Trump that they won't even come to the table on that one issue.
So, Senator Markey, before we let you go, and we're speaking with Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey here on Radio Boston, I want to pivot for a moment, mindful that COVID is out there and that President Biden made a statement earlier this week essentially declaring that the pandemic was over. This was on 60 Minutes. Do you agree with that in just a minute or so?
Well, we're not out of the woods yet. And I think it's important for people who are listening to know that 40% of the people who are in the hospital right now with COVID are boosted. 40% of the people who are in the hospital are boosted. So if you're over 65, if you're immunocompromised, if you're vulnerable, the pandemic is not over for you. Maybe there are some categories, younger people, much healthier people, that you could use that as a characterization, but it's the tale of two pandemics in a lot of ways. Okay, and for older people, it's not over. For those who are vulnerable, it's not over. For those who are hospitalized, it's not over. And so, I encourage everyone who can to schedule an appointment to receive the new booster, so that they can protect themselves and their family against the Omicron variant. But from my perspective, especially with the 80% of the people who have died of the million, which are all over 65, it's not over. Please protect yourself.
All right. That message from Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey joining us on the line here. Senator, always a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
So glad to be with you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director with help today from Michaela Valero. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.